Blog Talk Radio. This is not a very long essay. I'd rather do this. But I don't know if it will help you. It's called old age. And I don't know, everybody gets to that point, I guess. You never really want to believe that you are, but, you know, you do. And he gave this, I believe he gave this as a lecture. And it was under Society and Solitude, you know, his works, his essays. It says, on the anniversary of the Phi Beta Kappa Society, Cambridge in 1861. The venerable President Quincy, a senior member of the society as well as senior alumnus of university, was received at a dinner with particular demonstrations of respect. He replied to these compliments in a speech and gracefully claiming the privilege of a literary society, entered at some length into an apology for old age and aiding himself by notes in his hand, made a sort of running commentary on Cicero's chapter De Senectute. The character of the speaker, the transparent good faith of his praise and blame, and the naivety of his eager preference of Cicero's opinion of King David, gave unusual interest to the college festival. It was a discourse full of dignity, honoring him who spoke on those who heard. The speech led me to look over at home, an easy task. Cicero's famous essay, charming by its uniform rhetorical merit, heroic with stoical precepts, with a Roman eye to the claims of the state, happiest perhaps in his praise of life on the farm, and rising at the conclusion to a lofty strain. But he does not exhaust the subject, rather invites the attempt to add traits to the picture from our broader modern life. Cicero makes no reference to the illusions which cling to the element of time, and in which nature delights. Wellington, in speaking of a military man, said, "What masks are these uniforms to hide cowards?" And I have often detected the like deception in the cloth shoe, weighted pilis, wig, spectacles, and padded chair of age. Nature lends herself to these illusions and adds dim sight, deafness, cracked voice, snowy hair, short memory, and sleep. These also are masks, and all is not age that wears them. Whilst we yet call ourselves young and our mates are yet youths, and even boyish remains. One good fellow in the set prematurely sport a gray or a bald head, which does not impose on us who know how innocent of sanctity or of Platonism he is, but does deceive his juniors in the public, who presently distinguish him with the most amusing respect. And this lets us into the secret that the venerable forms that are so odd our childhood were just such imposters. Nature is full of freaks, and now put an old head on young shoulders, and then a young heart beating under fourscore winters. For if the essence of age is not present, these signs, whether of art or nature, are counterfeit and ridiculous. And the essence of age is intellect, whereas wherever that appears, we call it old. If we look into the eyes of the youngest person, we sometimes discover that here is one who knows already what you would go about with much pains to teach him. There is that in him which is the ancestor of all around him, which fact the Indian Vedas express when they say, "He that can discriminate is the father of his father." And in our old British legends of Arthur and Round Table, his friends and counselor Merlin the Wise is a babe found exposed in a basket by the riverside. And though an infant of only a few days speaks articulately to those who discover him, tells his name and his history, and presently foretells the fate of the bystander. Wherever there is power, there is age. And don't be deceived by dimples and curls. I tell you that babe is 1,000 years old. Time is indeed the theater and seat of illusion. Nothing is so ductile and elastic. The mind stretches an hour to a century and dwarfs an age to an hour. Saadi found in a mosque at Damascus an old Persian of 150 years, was dying and was saying to himself, "I said, coming into the world by birth, I will enjoy myself for a few moments. Alas, at the variegated table of life, I partook of a few mouthfuls, and the fate said enough." That which does not decay is so central and controlling in us that as long as one is alone by himself, he is not sensible of the inroads of time, which always begin at the surface edges. If on a winter day you should stand within a bell glass, the face and color of the afternoon clouds would not indicate whether it were June or January. And if we did not find the reflection of ourselves in the eaves of the young people, we could not know that the century clock had struck 70 instead of 20. And how many men habitually believe that each chance passenger with whom they converge is of their own age, and presently find it was his father and not his brother whom they knew. But not to press too hard on these deceits and illusions of nature, which are inseparable from our condition, and looking at age under an aspect more conformed to the common sense, If the question be the felicity of age, I fear that the first popular judgments will be unfavorable. From the point of sensuous experience, seen from the streets and markets and the haunts of pleasure and gain, the estimate of age is low, melancholy and skeptical. Frankly, face the facts and see the results. Tobacco, coffee, alcohol, hashish, prussiac acid, strychnine are weak delusions. The surest poison is time. This cup which nature puts to our lips has a wonderful virtue, surpassing that of any other draught. It opens the senses, adds power, fills us with exalted dreams which we can hope, love, ambition. Science, especially, it creates a craving for large draughts of itself. But they who take the larger draughts are drunk with it, lose their stature, strength, beauty, and senses, and end in folly and delirium. We postpone our literary work until we have more ripeness and skill to write, and we one day discover that our literary talent was youthful effervescence, which we have now lost. We have a judge in Massachusetts who at 60 proposed to resign, alleging that he perceived a certain decay in his faculties. He was dissuaded by friends on account of the public convenience at that time. At 70, it was hinted to him that it was time to retire, but he now replied that he thought his judgment as robust as his faculties, as good as ever it were. But besides the self-deception, the strong and hasty laborers of the street do not work well with the chronic valetudinarian. Youth is everywhere in place. Age, like woman, requires fit surroundings. Age is comely in coaches and churches and chairs of state and ceremony, in council chambers, in court of justice and historical societies. Age is becoming in the country, but in the rush and uproar of Broadway, if you look into the faces of the passengers, there is dejection and indignation in the seniors, a certain concealed sense of injury, and the lip made up with a heroic determination not to mind it. Few envy the consideration enjoyed by the oldest inhabitant. We do not count a man's years until he has nothing else to count. The vast inconvenience of animal immortality was told in the fable of Tithonius. In short, the creed of the street is old age is not disgraceful, but immensely disadvantageous. Life is well enough, but we shall all be glad to get out of it, and they will all be glad to have it, to have us. This is odious on the face of it. Universal convictions are not to be shaken by the whimsies of overfed butchers and firemen, or by the sentimental fears of girls who would keep the infantile bloom in their cheeks. We know the value of experience. Life and art are cumulative, and he who has accomplished something in any department alone deserves to be heard on that subject. A man of great employments and excellent performance used to assure me that he did not think a man worth anything unless he was 60. Although this smacks a little of resolution of a certain young men's Republican club, that all men should be held eligible who are under 70. But in all governments, the council of power were held by the old, and patricians are paters, senates or scenes, signors or seniors, Gusia, Gerusia, the Senate of Sparta, the Presbytery of the Church, and like all signify simply old men. The cynical creed of lamp or lampoon of the market is refuted by the universal prayer for long life, which is the verdict of nature and justified by all history. We have, it is true, examples of an accelerated pace by which young men achieve grand works, as in the Macedonian Alexander, in Raphael, Shakespeare, Pascal, Burns, and Byron. But these are rare exceptions. Nature, in the main, vindicates her law. Skill to do comes of doing. Knowledge comes by eye always open, and working hands, and there is no knowledge that is not power. Berenger said, almost all the good workmen live long, and by the life be true and noble. And if the life be true and noble, we have quite another sort of seniors than the frowsy, timorous, peevish dotards who are falsely old, namely the men who fear no city, but by whom cities stand, who, appearing in any street, the people empty their houses to gaze at and obey them, as at my Cid with the fleecy beard in Toledo, or Bruce, as Barber reported him, as blind old Dandolo elected Doge at 84 years, storming Constantinople at 94, and after the revolt again victorious and elected at the age of 96 to the throne of the Eastern Empire, which he declined and died dodged at 97. We will see the force of Socrates, whom will advise the oracle pronounced wisest of men of Archimedes, holding Syracuse against the Romans by his wit, and himself better than all their nation. Of Michelangelo, wearing the four crowns of architecture, sculpture, painting, and poetry. Of Galileo, of whose blindness Castelli said, the noblest eye is darkened that nature ever made. An eye that hath seen more than all that went before him, and hath opened the eyes of all that shall come after him. Of Newton, who made an important discovery for every one of his 85 years, of Bacon, who took all knowledge to be his province, of Fontanelli, that precious porcelain vase laid up in the center of France to be guarded with the utmost care for 100 years, of Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams, the wise and heroic statesmen, of Washington, the perfect citizen, of Wellington, the perfect soldier, of Goethe, the all-knowing poet, of Humboldt, the encyclopedia of science. Under the general assertion of the well-being of age, we can easily count particular benefits of that condition. It has weathered the perilous capes and shoals and the seas whereon we sail, and the chief evil of life is taken away in removing the grounds of fear. The insurance of a ship expires as she enters the harbor at home. It were strange if a man should turn his 60th year without a feeling of immense relief from the number of dangers he has escaped. When the old wife says, take care of the tumor on your shoulder, perhaps it is cancerous, he replies, I am yielding to assured decomposition. The humorous thief who drank a pot of beer at the gallows blew off the froth because he had heard it was unhealthy. But it will not add a pang of the prisoner's march out to be shot to assure him that the pain in his knee threatens mortification. When the pneumonia of the cow's rage, the butchers said that though the acute degree was novel, there never was a time when this disease could not occur among cattle. All men carry seeds of all distempers through life latent, and we die without developing them. But in the affirmative force of the Constitution, but if you are enfeebled by any cause, some of these sleeping seeds start and open. Meantime, at every age, we lose a foe. At 50 years, to said afflicted citizens lose their sick headaches. I hope this Hegira is not a movable feast, as that one I annually looked for, when the horticulturists assured me that the rosebugs in our garden disappear on the 10th of July. They stay a fortnight later in mine. But be it as it may that the sick headache, it is certain that graver headaches and heartaches are lulled once for all as we come up with certain goals of time. The passions have answered. Passions have answered their purpose. That slight but dread overweight, that which in each instance nature secures the execution of her aim, drops off. To keep man in the planet, she impresses the terror of death. To perfect the commiserate, she implants in each a certain rapacity to get the supply and a little oversupply of what his wants. To ensure the existence of the race, she reinforces the sexual instinct at the risk of disorder, grief, and pain. To secure strength, she says, she plants cruel hunger and thirst, which so easily overdo their office and invite disease. But these temporary stays and shifts for the protection of the young animal are shed as fast as they can be replaced by nobler resources. We live in youth amidst this rabble of passions, quite too tender, quite too hungry and irritable. Later, the interiors of mind and heart open and supply grander motives. We learn the fatal compensations that wait on every act. Then one after another, this riotous time, destroying crew disappear. I count it another capital advantage of age. This, that a success more or less signifies nothing. Little by little it has amassed such a fund of merit that it can very well afford to go on its credit when it will. When I chanced to meet the poet Wordsworth, then 63 years old, he told me that he had just had a fall and lost a tooth. And when his companions were much concerned for the mischance, he had replied that he was glad it had not happened 40 years before. Well, nature takes care that we shall not lose our organs 40 years too soon. A lawyer argued a cause yesterday in the Supreme Court, and I was struck with a certain air of levity and defiance that vastly became him. 30 years ago, it was a serious concern to him whether his pleading was good and effective. Now it is of importance to his clan, but of none to himself. It has been long already fixed that he can do and cannot do, and his reputation does not gain or suffer from one or a dozen new performances. If he should on a new occasion rise quite beyond his mark and achieve somewhat great and extraordinary, that, of course, would instantly tell. But he may go below his mark with impunity. And people will say, oh, he had a headache, or he lost his sleep for two nights. What a lust of appearance. What a load of anxieties that once degraded him, he is thus rid of. Everyone is sensible of his cumulative advantage in living. All the good days behind him as sponsors, who speak for him when he is silent, pay for him when he has no money, and introduce him where he has no letters, and work for him when he sleeps. A third felicity of age is that it has found expression. The youth suffers not only from ungratified desires, but from powers untried and from a picture in his mind of a career which has as yet no outward reality. He is tormented with the want of correspondence between things and thoughts. Michelangelo's head is full of masculine and gigantic figures as gods walking, which make him savage until his furious chisel can render them into marble, and of architectural dreams until 100 stonemasons can lay them in the course of travertine. There is the like tempest in every good head in which some great benefit for the world is planted. The throes continue until the child is born. Every faculty new to each man thus goads him and drives him out into doleful deserts until it finds proper vent. All the functions of human duty irritate and lash him forward, bemoaning and chiding until they are performed. He wants friends, employment, knowledge, power, house and land, wife and children, honor and fame. He has religious wants, aesthetic wants, domestic, civil, humane wants. One by one, day after day, he learns to coin his wishes into facts. He has his calling, homestead, social connection, and personal power, and thus at the end of 50 years his soul is appeased by seeing some sort of correspondence between his wish and his possession. This makes the value of age the satisfaction it slowly offers to every craving. He is serene who does not feel himself pinched and wronged, but whose condition, in particular and in general, allows the utterance of his mind. In old persons, when thus fully expressed, we often observe a fair, plump, perennial, waxen complexion that indicates that all the fervent of earlier years has subsided into serenity of thought and behavior. The compensations of nature play in age as in youth. In a world so charged and sparkled with power, a man does not live long and actively without costly additions of experience, which, though not spoken, are recorded in his mind. What to the youth is only a guess or a hope is in the veteran a digested statue. He beholds the feet of the juniors with complacency, but as one who, having long ago known his games, has refined them into results and morals. The Indian Red Jacket, when the young braves were boasting their deeds, said, "But the 60s have all the 20s and 40s in them." For a fourth benefit, age sets his house in order and finishes its work, which to every artist is a supreme pleasure. Youth has an excessive sensibility before which every object glitters and attracts. We leave one pursuit for another, and the young man's years is a heap of beginnings. At the end of a 12-month, he has nothing to show for it, not one complete work, but the time is not lost. Our instincts drove us to hive innumerable experiences that are yet of no visible value, in which we may keep for twice 7 years before they shall be wanted. The best things are of secular growth. The instincts of classifying marks, the wise and the healthy mind. Linnaeus projects his system, lays out his 24 classes of plants before yet he has found nature a single plant to justify certain of his classes. His seventh class has not won. In process of time, he finds in delight a little white trentellus, the only plant with seven petals and sometimes seven stamens, which constitutes a seventh class in conformity with his system. The conchologist builds his cabinet whilst as yet he has few shells. He labels shells for classes, cells for species. All but a few are empty, but every year fills some blanks with accelerating speed as he becomes knowing and known. And on an old scholar finds keen delight in verifying the impressive anecdotes and citations he has met with in miscellaneous readings and hearings in all the years of youth. We carry in memory important important anecdotes and have lost all clue to the author from whom we had them. We have a heroic speech from Rome or Greece, but cannot fix it on the man who said it. We have an admirable line earlier for us, ever and anon, resounding in our mind's ear, but have searched all possible and improbable books for it in vain. We consult the reading men, but strangely enough, they who know not everything know not this. But especially we have a certain insulated thought which haunts us, but remains insulated and barren. Well, there is nothing for us for all of this but patience and time. Time, yes, that is the finder, the unwearable explorer, no subject to casualties, omniscience, alas. And the day comes when the hidden author of our story is found, when the brave speech returns straight to the hero who said it, when the admirable verse finds the poet to whom it belongs, and best of all, when the lonely thought, which seems so wise, yet half-wise, half-thought, because he casts no light abroad, is suddenly matched in our mind by its twin, by its sequence, or next related analogy, which gives it instantly radiating power and justifies the superstitious instinct with which we have hoarded it. We remember our old Greek professor at Cambridge, an ancient bachelor, amid his folios, processed, or rather possessed by the hope of completing a task, with nothing to break his leisure after the 3 hours of his daily classes, yet ever restlessly stroking his leg and assuring himself he should retire from the university and read the authors. In Ghost Romance, Macaria, a central figure of wisdom and influence, pleasures herself with withdrawing into solitude to astronomy, epistolary correspondence. Goethe himself carried his completion of studies to the highest point. Many of his works hung on the easel from youth to age and received a stroke in every month or year. A literary astrologer, he never applied himself to any task but at the happy moment when all the stars consented. And Bentley thought himself likely to live till 80, though enough to read everything that was worth reading. Long enough to read everything that was worth reading. Et tun magna main, sub terris habit imago. Much wider is spread the pleasure which all men take in completing their secular affairs. The inventor, his inventions, the agriculturist, his experiments, and all men in finishing their houses, rounding their estates, clearing their titles, reducing tangled interests in order to order, reconciling enmities, and leaving all in the best posture for the future. It must be believed that there is a portion between the design of a man and the length of his life. There is a calendar of his years, so of his performance. America is the country of young men, and too full of work hitherto for leisure and tranquility. Yet we have had robust centenarians, and examples of dignity and wisdom. I have lately found in an old notebook a record of a visit to ex-President John Adams in 1825, and soon after the election of his son to the presidency. It is but a sketch, and nothing important passed in the conversation, but it reports a moment in the life of a heroic person who, in extreme old age, appeared still erect and worthy of his fame. He says, today at Quincy with my brother, by invitation of Mr. Adams' family, The old president sat in a large stuffed armchair dressed in a blue coat, black small clothes, white stockings, a cotton cap above his bald head. And he made our compliment, told him he must let us join. He must let us join our congratulations to those of the nation on the happiest of his house. He thanked us and said, "I am rejoiced because the nation is happy. A time of congratulations is nearly over with me. I am astonished that I have lived to see and know of this event. I have lived now nearly a century." He was 90 in the following October. "In long, harassed, and distracted life," I said, the world thinks a good deal of joy has mixed with it. The world does not know," he replied, "how much toil, anxiety, and sorrow I have suffered." I asked if Mr. Adams' letter of acceptance had been read to him. "Yes," he said, and added, "my son has more political prudence than any man that I know who has existed in my time. He was never put off his guard, and I hope he will continue such. But what effect age may work in diminishing the power of his mind, I do not know. It has been very much on the stretch ever since he was born. He has always been laborious, child and man from infancy." When Mr. J.Q. Adams' age was mentioned, he said, "He is now 58, or will be in July," and remarked that all the presidents were of the same age. General Washington was about 58, and I was about 58, and Mr. Jefferson, and Mr. Madison, and Mr. Monroe. We inquired when he expected to see Mr. Adams, and he said, "Never. Mr. Adams will not come to Quincy, but to my funeral. It would be a great satisfaction to me to see him, but I don't wish him to come on my account." He spoke of Mr. Lechmere, whom he well remembered to have seen come down daily at a great age to walk in the old town house, adding, "And I wish I could walk as well as he did. He was a collector of the customs for many years under the royal government." And he said, "I suppose, sir, you would not have taken his place, even to walk as well as he." "No," he replied, "that was not what I wanted." He talked of Whitefield, and remembered, when he was a freshman in college, to have come into town to the old South Church to hear him, but could not get into the house. "I, however, saw him," he said, "through a window, and distinctly heard all. He had a voice such as I never heard before or since. He cast it out so that you might hear it at the meeting house," pointing toward the Quincy meeting house, "and he had the grace of dancing, of a dancing master, of an actor of plays. His voice and manner helped him move more than his sermons. I went with Jonathan Sewell, and you were pleased with him, sir." "Pleased," I said, "delighted beyond measure." He asked if at Whitfield's return the same popularity continued. "Not the same fury," he said, "not the same wild enthusiasm as before, but a greater esteem as he became more known. He did not terrify, but he was admired." We spent about an hour in his room. He speaks very distinctly for an old man, and enters bravely into long sentences which are interrupted by want of breath, but carries them invariably to a conclusion without correcting a word. He spoke of the new novels of Cooper and Pepys, and Peep at the Pilgrims and Saratoga, and praised, and said with accuracy that the characters in them, he likes to have a person always reading to him, or company talking in his room, and it is better the next day after having visitors in his chambers from morning to night. He received a premature report of his son's election on Sunday afternoon, without any excitement, and told the reporter he had been hoaxed, for it was not that time for any news to arrive. And the informer, something damped in his heart, insisted on repairing to the meeting house and proclaimed it aloud to the congregation, who were so overjoyed that they rose in their seats and cheered thrice. Reverend Mr. Whitney dismissed them immediately. When life has been spent, age is a loss of what it can well spare. Muscular strengths, organic instincts, gross bulk, and works that belong to these. But the central wisdom, which was old in infancy, is young in 80 years and dropping off to obstructions, leaves in happy subjects the mind purified and wise. I have heard that whoever loves is in no condition old. I have heard that whenever the name of man is spoken, doctrine of immortality is announced. It cleaves to his constitution. The mode of it battles our wit, and no whisper comes to us from the other side. But the interference from the working of intellect, hiving knowledge, hiving skill, at the end of life, just ready to be born, affirms the inspirations of affection and the moral sentiment. And that's the end of that essay. And I wanted to comment a bit on it because I just had a birthday this month. And yes, I'm getting older. And I went through a hell of a time last year when I was, with some illness and with some disappointments and so on. And it made me try to gather myself, which is something I guess I really hadn't done before up until then, or even up until now. And I started to consider what I had, what I have, and what I wish to have. And I tried to comprehend I tried to consider what my demise or my death would mean to others, what it would mean to future, what it would mean to anybody. And I took time, expensive time, to concentrate on this aspect, because I really, even to this day, don't know how much longer I have to live, or nobody does. Nobody can say, gee, I'm going to live forever. No, things happen and you're done. And, you have to. So, whether you're rich or poor or destitute or, whatever you are, it comes to you, wealth and fame and fortune or intellect is no guarantee, of your future. No matter how smart you are, there's always a time of lapse. You could die in your sleep. You could be misdiagnosed. You could be, who knows? There's just so many variables that it's almost impossible to comprehend, or it's almost an illusion, a delusion, if you will, to think of a future specifically. as if it's going to all happen as you see it. Because it doesn't. It happens in different ways. You can project it. You can move ahead. You can discern more or less what tomorrow will be like. But you can't guarantee it. Life gives you no guarantees. It's never given me any. And I move from day to day from in the hope of completing a task, doing another show, possibly expounding on some subject that might enlighten someone else or myself. I look forward to friends, seeing friends. I look forward to hearing people, loved ones, mother, sister, wife, or girlfriends, or whatever is your closest relationships. Those are the ones that you want to hear from most of the time, or that you enjoy hearing from. And because of that, each moment that you spend with those people is very precious. As the every moment that you spend doing something of industry, something industrious, something not to do that. I try not to spend any time thinking or invest any time at all thinking of those areas, thinking of my past, thinking of my future. Yes, I guess everybody does. But to concentrate simply on the present is virtually impossible. We're creatures of past, present, and future. So to give up everything to concentrate on the present is, giving up your two arms and two legs to so that you can be here now in the present, The whole key to having arms and legs is to be able to do something in the future, be able to assist you as tools to achieving or building your future or repairing your past. So essentially that's what the present is, and the present is that moment that you have to down. You know, whatever reason we exist for, the great prophets, philosophers, thinkers, have all come down to the bare essential of we are here for a purpose. We're here to achieve some purpose. The fact that I've lived to be almost 60 years old tells me that I've suffered a number of setbacks and failures and relationships and all of these things, but I've never given up the hope that these can be that I can learn from these things and utilize these failures or successes and the knowledge I've achieved from them to do something else, to do something better, to create something new, to write another article, to do another show, you know, to paint another picture, to take another picture, to, you know, there's so much that needs to be said, so much that needs to be written, so much that needs to be learned, not just by me, but by everyone, you know. We all learn from others, and others learn from us. And because of that, we co-create our realities. And I believe I've touched on this in the past on other programs, but the co-creation of our reality involves that of others and God, you know, co-creating with God, but also co-creating with others, with families, with lives, with friends, with employers and employees, you know. Masters and apprentices, journeymen, we all are here to continue to create. And we're all co-creating constantly. We are doing that. So this myth, if you will, that we're entering a time when we'll be co-creators, we are co-creators. We've always been co-creators. That's not a changing thing. You know, the only difference is that maybe now we're aware of the power that we have to co-create or to create. But I can't create anything without having had the knowledge, the inspiration from someone else or something else. I'm totally dependent, not independent. I'm totally dependent upon my receptive self, you know, whatever comes to me, whatever inspires me from some works that I've read or things that I've heard or nature that I see or some action or reaction that I have to something, it's what creates, what pushes me forward to create. By reading this essay tonight, it's because the essay challenged something in me to do, to read it. I felt compelled to read this tonight, and then compelled later to comment on it in the way that I have. So, in essence, I have co-created this program, not only with the network that it's on, but also with the knowledge I've received from Emerson and the understanding that I've had over the many years. developing an awareness and understanding of Emerson's work that I can coherently read it, you know, and try to present it. And so doing, I'm hoping that, you know, many people will be listening to this program. I was so amazed at the audience I received on the essay on demonology. I don't think I've ever had as many people listen to one program that I've delivered on a Thursday night. I mean, we're virtually, you know, it's a very, very good audience, hundreds of people. But that's, you know, and people are continually going to that particular show in the archives. So why something catches other people, why something might go viral, you know, on YouTube or whatever, is because it touches some universal need or want in human nature that propels us to have it, to seek it out, to enjoy it, or to analyze it for our own benefit, either it be for entertainment or for scholarly pursuit or for philosophical insight or spiritual insight. Whatever it is that draws us to whatever it is we're drawn to is because it touches on a universal theme. I mean, if you enjoy evangelical television, it's because somehow it fulfills some need in you. If you enjoy porn, pornography, it's because it does the same thing. It compels you, you know, it satisfies some need and desire within you to fulfill. So regardless of what your interests are, they're simply your fulfillment or seeking fulfillment of your basic natural desire for, you know, for that particular thing. And it's really irrelevant to me or to you what my needs are, because essentially my needs are the same as your needs. We need food, we need shelter, we need entertainment, you know, we need clothing, we need friendship, we need, you know, knowledge, experience, inspiration. These are all things that we seek, all things that we cry for, all things that we do. And once we receive that and are satisfied, then we can project all of these things onto some great canvas, if you will, as artists, as expressors of some divine and humanly divine consciousness. So, with that thought, I'll end tonight's show just stating to you that, reminding you that you are who you are. And whatever you're pursuing is part of your nature, part of your destiny, part of your fate. And just try to make the best use of your time, best use of your knowledge, best use of your